Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. You can see the first Hannibal Lecter movie with Michael Mann's Manhunter. Maybe take a trip around the UK with Ben Wheatley's Sightseers. There are world cinema treats such as The Host and Eight Women. And vintage classics too, with favourites such as Passport to Pimlico and The Titfield Thunderbolt. This episode is a special one, as I'm joined by Mike Figgis, the writer and director of the Oscar-winning drama Leaving Las Vegas. The film, starring Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue, is arriving on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray for the first time. 3 decades after its release, Mike joined me for a long chat about the film, and you can hear it after this clip.
I just want to know, why are you killing yourself?
Interesting choice of words. I don't remember. I just know that I want to.
Are you saying that your drinking is a way to kill yourself?
Or killing myself is a way to drink?
Very clever.
So what a thrill it is to welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast for a very special episode, writer, director, Mike Figgis. Hello, Mike Figgis. How are you?
I'm fine. Hello, Simon, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I should introduce you as a musician as well, because that's also going to come up, hopefully, in the conversation we're about to have. Mm-hmm. But we're sat here on the eve of the release of a 30th anniversary restoration of Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And a film for which you picked up a couple of Oscar nominations, and a film for which I wonder what it's like for a filmmaker, like 3 decades on, when someone wants to restore your film, particularly one that you've had to scrap so much to make. I mean, can you kind of capture that for us just to set it up?
Well, it kind of comes out of, in a sense, out of the blue. So the background to this was that both Studio Canal and MGM sort of separately made a decision, I guess, because the anniversary was coming up, to make some kind of restoration of the film. And then I put them in touch with each other and suggested that also that we try and find the negative, which at that point was sort of missing in action somewhere, so they could go back to the original Super 16mm and scan from the negative, which, of course, is always the best result. So there's a kind of technical process leading up to this release, which was technical. Yeah. You know, just like, okay, check this, check that. So almost without a kind of psychological particular connection to the film itself, it was a sort of a process. And funny enough, the year before, the same thing had happened on Internal Affairs.
Yeah.
And then roundabout now, the same thing is happening on a film which I love called Liebestraum.
I remember that.
So from that period, of really my Hollywood period, there's 3 separate films. So it's like, oh, that's interesting, you know, because meanwhile, you are just kind of like, as Coppola would say, you know, hurling yourself towards the next brick wall, trying to get through and just get something made, you know, by whatever means. And so then there was this kind of like lead up to the, you know, there was a really big screening in Berlin. And then I've just come back from Paris for a lovely screening there. And suddenly you are much more confronted by the film. You watch the film with an audience, most of whom are of a generation that either wasn't born or was very, very young. Plus some people who are now seeing it again, having seen it as, let's say, a 20-year-old and now seeing it as a 50-year-old or something like that. And so obviously a lot of dialogue like today, we're going to talk about it. And that opens up parts of the memory that have been closed or just ignored for quite a while. And so long answer to your short question is, when I saw the film in Berlin, for example, my response was quite strange. I mean, I found a sort of detachment from like myself, in the sense that you go, I felt very proud of the younger Mike.
Yeah.
I'd sort of like asked lots of questions like, wow, So I know it was a really difficult process. And so to have, I always say to my film students, you know, if you're going to make a film, you have to have incredible patience and an incredible belief in what you're doing. And if those, either one of those is under par, you probably won't get to make your film. So I was thinking of that, but this kind of attachment and detachment at the same time, which was very, very nice. And also a kind of feeling of gratitude, because particularly now you make a film, goes out on a platform, yeah, it's then, you know, it's in their top 10 for a couple of weeks, and then it kind of just sinks to the bottom of a vast pile. Yeah. And when I made Leaving Las Vegas, the film world was a very, very different place. So all of those things where you kind of, real gratitude that even now in this saturated market, the film is coming out. But also, when I went to promote Megadoc, and also it coincided with the American release of Leaving Las Vegas, re-release, yeah, I became very aware in New York and in LA, for sure, of this kind of resurgence among young cinephiles of enthusiasm to see films in a, yeah, theater and to revisit, or in a lot of cases, to visit for the first time, the world of the cinema of 30 years ago, which very much was where I came from. So when I first went to Hollywood, I was very much riffing off Robert Altman and all the really interesting indie filmmakers, American filmmakers, who, for me, had created this kind of American cinema that I was totally in awe of. It's nice that that is also repeating.
The making of story in itself is, I mean, for us on the outside looking in, extraordinary. And I remember an interview that Roger Ebert had done with Nicolas Cage at the time the film came out, because you shot this on Super 16. And Roger Ebert said a lot of people use 16 to break into the industry, but Mike Figgis and you and Elizabeth Shue have all made lots of big budget 35mm movies. So maybe the impetus here was to break out of the industry. I thought that was a great question.
That's a great
question. Not my question, entirely his, but was there something to that?
Absolutely. I mean, you start looking for escape routes, you know, from the restriction of shooting the film under the benevolent, you know, dictatorship of the studio. I mean, in the past, if you were lucky enough, you found a maverick, eccentric studio boss that kind of somehow got it, loved cinema in a certain way. I, yep, mean, the history of cinema does have lots of these examples. But after the sort of 80s, early 80s corporate takeover of Paramount, yeah, post Bob Evans and all of that, you suddenly see it's you know, this is all about marketing and it's about money. And then all the big agencies, Mikovits and so on, you know, they become just about marketing. Yeah. So, and that's when I come into Hollywood, you know, so just in time for this wonderful sea change. So after, you know, let's say Internal Affairs somehow got under the radar, God knows, yeah, how, and it was my first film, so I was naively unprepared for what would follow with Liebestraum, with Mr. Jones, all of those shot on 35, and then realizing that part of the deal was, if you want to escape that kind of, you know, nanny studio state, then you're going to have to do things technically which kind of delete your connection to them. And one of those is don't shoot on 35, at which point they're not interested anymore, because 16 millimeter for them is a joke. One of the things that really shocked me, having grown up, you know, in British TV culture where BBC shot everything on 16, yeah, and it was really, really good, to discover that all American television was shot on 35. And you kind of think, well, it's not only, it's NTSC, so it doesn't look as good as PAL, you know, and the TVs all look like, you know, you should be wearing special glasses or something, you know. So the quality of TVs in people's homes, and the bigger they got, the worse, yeah, the worse it looked, right? You know, and they're shooting this on 35 like it's a feature film. You kind of go, this is insane. Why, you know, this is, if it was a car manufacturing company, you'd kind of go, okay, let's reboot, you know. So anyway, Super 16 gave me a sort of immediately a technical freedom, but then it also gave me like a physical freedom, because I meant I could shoot lighter cameras, not so much equipment. So Leaving Las Vegas became a kind of almost pre-dogma manifesto, which is, I laid it down very, very super clear with everybody. Okay, we're not going to use cranes. We're not going to use tracking. You know, we're going to use minimum lighting. I don't want any big trucks. The schedule is the schedule. It's not negotiable. Yeah. If it says 2 o'clock in a shopping mall, leave at 5, we leave at 5, regardless. Yeah. And once everybody knew that that was a serious kind of thing, we stuck to the schedule, and also we got the shot that we wanted because we knew that there wasn't an alternative to it. Just one day when that went wrong, when I relaxed, had a cappuccino and a cigarette, and the DP started lighting, and then we lost a whole day suddenly because we were back into the La La Land of, you know, Hollywood filmmaking. But that was only just one day. The rest was all like perfect.
So when you've got limited funds and when, let's creatively say, you've not got much permission to shoot in some of the places that you were shooting in, what happens when you lose a day? What's the impact of that as opposed to something like losing a day on Internal Affairs?
Okay, the losing the day was the scene early on in the film where Nicolas Cage burns all his scripts and he packs up his house and he gets in his BMW and he drives to Las Vegas. So what was planned for that day was a couple of scenes, one where you see him outside and there's a film being shot by a big film company, right? With all their trucks, which, as I recall, we found a film company that was shooting because Hollywood, you know, there was always shooting something. And we had him walking through that kind of environment. For me, it was nice, which is I'm leaving this behind and here he is walking. He's the me character, right? And then he goes into his house and there was meant to be extended scenes where he's looking at the room where he's obviously got a child. You see manifestations of his failed marriage and all of that. And it was kind of, as I recall, there were, you know, like three or four quite poignant scenes. And so we got in there, and as I say, I did the cappuccino mistake and I, you know, started gossiping with people. And it was nice because it was in LA, it was relaxed. The house we were shooting in was very nice. And I kept saying to Declan, you know, how long? And he goes, oh, give us another 40 minutes because we're just having a little moment. I'm like, fine, I'll just have another cappuccino. And then, you know, suddenly it was like mid-afternoon and I was going, what's happening? And what was happening was that the beautiful sunlight that had been pouring through the windows all day was now, the sun was going down, and now Declan was having to light for what was meant to be a daylight scene. Yeah. And then the location manager came and said, look, we're in a kind of very residential neighborhood, and they pull the permit at 7, and that's not negotiable. And they're already pissed off because, you know, your people are outside and, you know, and blah, 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 the usual, right? And I suddenly thought, this is ridiculous. So actually what I did was pretty good. I sort of said, okay, I'm taking over now. Okay, Declan, you're going handheld. I said to Pavel, the sound guy, you know, just stick the microphones in these rooms, put strong light bulbs in each room. And I said, we're going to do it in single takes. Light a bonfire in the garden. And I said to Nicholas, okay, we're just going to follow you. Wherever you go and you're high energy, you're going to burn all your scripts, you're going to look at Polaroids, you're going to do all that stuff. And I just said, no more waiting for light. So that was this lit with those light bulbs. So all the whole day had gone with this beautiful lighting of fake sunlight coming through. And I just went, no. Executive decision, get rid of all of that, just go single take. I think there's even... there's a little interview with me in the making of in the room with Valdemar, the production designer, talking about that. And I don't know whether it's, I can't remember whether it's before I made the decision or after, but I remember that location is represented in the documentary. And actually, it's a much better scene for it. So when I say we lost a day, it's like, we did lose a day, but I didn't lose the shot. I came up with a better shot.
So the moral of the story is more cappuccino, Mike, surely.
Yeah, more cappuccino. And also the ability to, which here's the difficult part. When you're on a film set and a bunch of people are telling you why it's going slow and why you can't shoot, actually, the answer is often just to say, and I think there's a story about Spielberg, I think, shooting... you know, the J.G. Ballard film, and he's struggling with whoever's shooting that film. And I think he does one of those things like, and they said, we just need 40 minutes more. And he kind of says, okay, we're shooting, actually. Yeah. Whether you're ready or not, the camera will be rolling, and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's the lesson. Sometimes as a director, you have to grow that extra muscle and just sort of be prepared to just say no. We're going to go, you know, I know, whatever lighting state you're at, because you're always going to be bullied by that. And by the way, the DP is of course, trying to do the best thing possible because he wants the work to look good. And sometimes I see them, they're struggling. They hit a problem and they need to relight or something like that. It's just not working for them.
So the DP here you've mentioned is Declan Quinn, for those unfamiliar. And one of the things you write about in your book is how you operated the camera for, I think it's a 50-50 split roughly on it, and how that got you closer to the actors. And I'm just curious, just as a pure director, how does that change the experience and what you get when you're operating the camera, particularly when the shots here are so close to the characters' faces?
Well, I'll try and condense, but you know, I've always been a stills photographer. Yes. So, you know, I was taking stills from the age of 11. I was always in love with photography. And then my love for cinema really came out of photography because of the relationship between light, because it was, I realized very early age, it was all about lighting. So I became fascinated by light sources in stills photography and in painting and things like that. And then when I was doing my sort of performance art period, you know, lighting became a key thing to learn, you know, how to light and the minimum amount of lighting that would be, you know, my favorite quote is from, and I never remember his name, very famous French film noir DP from the 50s, who famously said, "One light is divine, two lights interesting, three lights impossible." Because when you have the third light, you go, well, what shall I do with that? I've got a light on the face. I've got some, you know, blah, blah, blah. The third light is like, oh, well, I should use it this. By the time you get to 20 lights, it's like, I see people, and you watch a Netflix movie now, it's just like, there is no darkness. Yeah. There is like, everything is lit. And so when I started making films in Hollywood, I was immediately kind of banished to the video monitor, which is at an angle to where the actors are working. And I remember Julia Roberts saying to me, "Mike, you've got to understand, we don't really care about the director. The only important person for us is the DP, because that's who we're acting to the camera." Yeah. Now, when I did the Browning version, Jean-François Robin was this beautiful DP. He'd shot Betty Blue. Yeah. And he invited me to shoot second camera on a couple of scenes on 35. Yeah. And I went, oh, well, you know, it's too complicated, because they had the special handles on the tripod, you know, with the two rotating handles. And he, you know, I'll give you a lesson. And it, of course, it wasn't that complicated. And so next film up was Leaving Las Vegas. So part of my thing was, and I owned a 16 millimeter camera, Super 16 camera. And I said to Declan, I want to shoot on 16 and I want two cameras and I want to be the other camera. And he said, fine. Yeah. So we had a very nice relationship on that film where he would do the master, he would shoot, I'd let him choose the shot. And then once he'd lit for that with very simple lighting, I would just kind of walk around with one eye kind of half closed, go, oh, this is great angle. And I'd set up my camera, usually much closer than his. So I was using a zoom. And so I, you know, I'm all about the face. And, the, you know, I go back to my other favorite quote, which is Bergman saying, cinema is the ongoing exploration of the human face. 100%, yeah. I agree with that. So I would have the freedom, and it didn't matter if I fucked up, if I was out of focus, because I knew Declan was getting all the good stuff. And I knew the script really well, which DP's never known the script. So I know if Elizabeth is going to say something, I know what she's going to do. So I was, in a sense, very well informed about the kind of physical choreography. And so I would do those things. I'd get the hand, I'd get, you know, the hand coming up to the face, I'd get, so all that very, very tight, intimate stuff, I'm pretty sure is me, but the mists of time, who knows? But suddenly I had contact with my actors and I could talk to them through the camera. I could say, you know, keep running, do it again. And once I got into video and I started shooting, you know, my video films, and I had this conversation with David Lynch, and he said the same thing. Once you start shooting on these little video cameras, you actually don't need a crew anymore. And you're running for 45 minutes on a, you know, one tape, and you can just say, do it again. Move around, change a light bulb. You don't have to do cut, cut, cut. And so Leaving Las Vegas was very much the opening into a whole
interesting
new possibility of filmmaking, and one that I had been yearning for that all those years, actually.
You mentioned Elizabeth there, Elizabeth Shue, of course, the co-star of the film. And a lot of conversation around Leaving Las Vegas centres around Nicolas Cage's extraordinary Oscar-winning performance. But the one that always gets me is Elizabeth Shue, and a name check for Julian Sands' very, very impactful moments in the film as well. But can you talk about casting? Because I don't hear this story as much. Can you talk about casting Elizabeth Shue and like working with her on the film?
This is a lovely story because I did Stormy Monday, right? And it got rather viciously critiqued here by people like Alexander Walker and so on, you know. But they wrote very nasty things about, you know, like this guy should stick to doing rock videos, which I'd never done before, that was funny. And also, you know, they didn't like the film, but the film was a little bit of a hit in America and got great reviews in New York Times and LA Times, right? And so on the strength of that, I was offered a film called The Hotspot.
Oh, okay.
Which meant rewriting. Yeah,
Dennis Hopper
eventually directed it. But and I was all set to shoot that. I was in pre-production, you know, with Sam Shepard and Ann Archer and Uma Thurman. But in the casting process for that, I met Elizabeth Shue, and I had an extraordinary afternoon with her where she came to the hotel, famous Chateau Marmont. There was a casting director there. And I had been given a little mini suite of rooms so we could do casting, you know, in the suite. So we went up in the old shaky old elevator to my room. So me, Elizabeth, and the casting director. And as we got out, Elizabeth turned to the casting director and said, "Would you mind not being here? I'd rather just read with Mike. I don't want to read with the kid." Because normally the casting director would do the line.
Yeah.
So the casting director was a bit miffed. And she went, well, you know, and also it wasn't usual. And so she said, okay. She looked at me and said, "Is that?" I said, "No, it's fine." So we went in and we read for maybe 2 hours. And extraordinary. And I read with her because I had been an actor. And I read an interview with her the other day and she said, you know, Mike's a really good actor. So that was very sweet. And we read the part that eventually, and I was blown away by her performance. Unfortunately, I then met Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
I say unfortunately, who was also amazing. I was, I think, 18 at the time. And I thought, wow, she is going to be a huge star. And she was really, really good. And it's one of those really tough decisions. And I cast Uma. And then, of course, the film fell apart for here very funny reasons, but it's another story. And I moved on and did Internal Affairs instead. I then discovered afterwards that Elizabeth was pretty devastated because we had had such a great reading and then it looked like I was going to cast her and then I didn't. So it's one of those. And she was really, really, really devastated by that. Plus, she had a terrible thing happen to her, which her brother died kind of in her arms,
okay.
You know, and they were like a very sporty family. He fell off a swing and, you know, he said, "Oh, that really hurt." Anyway, he'd punctured his lung and they were trying to get him to a hospital and he actually died while they were trying to. And so she'd gone through this terrible thing. And I bumped into her again. This is maybe 2-3 years later at the Chateau Marmont. And I think we got drunk together and she told me all of this. And I said, I apologized and everything. And I said, "But I've got this other thing. It's really low budget, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if I even get the money, but I would love you to play. I'm not just to read it. I'd love you to play the part of, you know, the main character." And so I never showed it to anybody else. I never even thought of anybody else. For me, it was always Elizabeth Shue. And she read it and she went, "I love it." And the same with Nicholas. He read it. He wrote to me and said, "Don't offer this to anybody else." So the only time in my career where the two leads never went out to casting. And I agree with you. I think Elizabeth Shue's is the standout performance. It's a very close, it's not a race, but she never drops the ball for 1 second. And she is absolutely amazing.
It's all happening really quickly. I just felt like we've been together for a long time, you know, it just felt so easy and I felt like, I felt like I was me. I didn't feel like I was trying to be somebody else.
And then most of the subsidiary casting in Leaving Las Vegas is from a very tight group of my friends in Los Angeles at that time. So it would be like Julian Lennon, Danny Houston, Mariska Hegarty, all these characters were just like, "Do you want to come and just do it? It'll be fun. We're shooting in LA or whatever. Do you want to just do 1 or 2 days on the film?" You know, And everybody said, yeah. Oh, and then obviously people like Lou Rawls, who was a kind of blues hero of mine, you know. And then some odd little kind of almost like a little bit kind of cute pieces of acting where, the guy from Full Metal Jacket and the guy from Living in Oblivion, you know, which yep. you know, like film geeks, they kind of go, oh, I recognize that guy. So.
So just in terms of film geeks, you had me at the list at the table near the start with all the scripts that Nicolas Cage has on his table. And I'm looking at it, just saying, he's not used prop scripts there. Is it Angie I Says is in there? He Said, She Said. I remember these films. Beverly Hills Cop 3. It's just like, you've just got those off your shelf, haven't you? And just put them on a table.
Absolutely. And then of course, I burn them.
Yeah. So you actually burned those scripts as well.
Yeah. And you see CAA and you see it burning. You see ICM and you see it burning, you know. So, yes, there were people say, was it revenge? And I go, so it was kind of catharsis, really, just like all the comments at the beginning when he meets the two agents, you know, and he goes, you know, are you at MGM? Say hello to Mike. Of course, reference to Mike Medavoy. He's not there anymore.
Just finished reading his book, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Roger Ebert was on the money, wasn't he? This was your breaking out, breaking out of the industry.
Bless him, you know. I have a wonderful giveaway pen from Roger, you know, and he gave it to me. We were doing an interview and I said, oh, thanks. Something's like a cheap pen, right? And he said, no, read it. And I went, well, read the pen. So on the side of the pen, it says, film noir is a neon lit wet street at night, cobblestone street at night. And he said, that's a quote from my review of Stormy Monday. And that's on his pen, you know.
Oh, so my.
It's on my shelf along with Roland Kirk's plastic flute. And then I got at Ronnie Scott's and things like that. Yeah. He was lovely. He was very, very good to me. And his review also of Loss of Sexual Innocence, you know, I really treasure it. And these people really, you know, at different points, you know, it's like when someone said, you know, I did an interview, I think, for the Times Literary Supplement once or Times Education Supplement, when they said, just talk about your favorite teacher. And I just talk about, you know, one teacher who encouraged me to play music.
Yeah.
And I wrote about him and just Mr. Ormston and how that actually got me into music school and everything like that. And, you know, and then he wrote to me and said, and he was still alive. He said, I just read your article about me. And he was so, and it was such a wonderful
That's lovely.
Moment. But, you know, a teacher or a critic that believes in you when you're just starting up, you know, you can't underestimate how important that is in your life. You know, it sort of gives you the kind of the encouragement and the rocket to keep going, basically. Yeah.
That's incredible. Before our time wraps up, I mean, you've mentioned music once or twice, and going back to the book, your digital filmmaking book, you do put a little anecdote in there about you had no money for the score for Leaving Las Vegas. And so you wrote you were using keyboards, samples, and a small group of improvisational jazz musicians. And I just wonder, just in terms of happy memories of filmmaking, I wonder if that's right up there when you've got absolutely nothing and you get to create something so extraordinary.
Yeah, you've just said, paraphrase it, you have absolutely nothing and you have absolute control. And I, you know, these musicians are amazing. So you bring them into a small studio and you give them some headphones and say, watch the film and play, just play along. And of course, my mentor, if you like, in life, the two of me, like Goddard and Miles Davis. So, you know, when the story behind Lift to the Scaffold, where, you know, Louis Malle invites him in and says, here's the film, just play. And they played along to the film. And I was like, yes, that's how you do it, you know. So this was very much an homage to that moment in music history, because not only is it a great score, it changed Miles Davis's life, because his style changed after that because he'd done film music. And that's a whole different subject. But and I remember moments of such intense emotion where Maggie Nichols, who is this incredible free jazz singer who can sing, you know, fake octaves and sing two notes at the same time. The scene where Nicholas is like having his spasms and trying to drink the orange juice and so he can get the vodka in. And the orange juice, technicality of that is when you're an advanced alcoholic, your stomach will reject alcohol unless you put something like food in first. So that would be the orange juice. So his struggle at the refrigerator on the floor, and I remember showing it to Maggie, just saying, and she was singing, watching the scene, and she was responding to his pain, you know. And when I saw the film in Berlin and watched that scene, that all came back to me, because the result of that is so visceral for her voice. And then, these behind-the-scene heroines and heroes would be the musicians, and particularly Maggie Nichols, whose female voice adds a level of emotion to the film which no other medium could do, because sound is the most pure, direct access to the heart.
And can I ask, because I read the special thanks at the end of credits, because I think oftentimes with independent film in particular, you find the real story of the film in those credits. And the first people you list are the O'Brien family. And I think that there's some familiarity that John O'Brien, who wrote the memoir, took his own life just ahead of shooting of this. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder if you can talk to the importance of the O'Brien family through the film and through the release of the film.
I mean, you know, again, I actually was thinking about this the other day, because about the most intense moment on the shooting of the film occurred after we'd left Vegas, and we were now shooting in a warehouse in the valley on the other side of Los Angeles, you know. So it's kind of an industrial estate. And so we built the set of the interior of Sarah's apartment. And so we were shooting that. And two cameras. And it was the scene where, towards the end of the film, where Nicholas is, had a shower, and he looks like a ghost. Yeah. And she's really worried, and she's cooked some rice. And she says, first time she drops their vow, and she says, I want you to see a doctor. And you know, as soon as she says that it's over for them, you know. And he starts crunching ice. And at that moment, some visitors in my peripheral vision, because I was on a camera, I saw a group of women coming into the set. So it was John O'Brien's parents, his sister, and his wife that he was divorced from. But, you know, and they came in, and I, you know, the AD does what you do on those when you have a VIP, which clearly they were. You offer them some headphones, some cams, you know, so they can hear what's being shot. So we started shooting that scene. So I'm shooting, and it's already incredibly emotional, but suddenly you've got the O'Brien family there on your right-hand side. And I saw Mrs. O'Brien, his mother, just suddenly take the headphones off. And she handed them to her daughter, who had exactly the same response. Yeah. They watched for a bit, and then they took the headphones off. It was too much. And so afterwards, we took a break and a coffee, and I went to say hello to them. I hadn't met them before. They were this absolutely beautiful, beautiful family. And I heard from them, funny enough, the other day. They wrote to me, and they just talked about their son, about John, and, you know, how the book was a kind of, you know, a letter, a kind of autobiographical letter. And then they talked about watching Nicholas, and they just said it was just too much, because he had become and Nicholas never met John O'Brien, and we only had a photograph of him, but she said his speech patterns, everything was John O'Brien, and it was too much for them. It was unbearable. And of course, it's live, it's not a film, you know, it was unbearable. And I literally saw them taking the headphones off, like almost with pain, you know. I would say that was one of the most visceral kind of emotional moments in my life, you know, where the few occasions where film isn't replicating something, it actually has taken you back into some moment that you don't even know about. I mean, because I didn't know John either, you know. So that was super powerful. And then we became really like good friends through the whole award season, and kept in touch. And as I said, maybe just even 2 months ago, I heard from Mrs. O'Brien again. And I wrote back and I said, oh, it's terribly exciting that they're doing all of this, you know. So yeah, I'll write to them again. Now,
I mean, just to tie all of this up, have you had a film quite like this in your career that's resonated quite so much? Even the fact we're discussing it in such depth 3 decades later, it just strikes me as extraordinary.
Well, films all function in different ways. So you have your kind of like your family or your kids or whatever. So it's the most emotional, visceral, responded film that I've made.
Yeah.
And also, you know, by the way, it was fun to make this. It was a joyous experience. It was a liberation. I loved everybody I was working with. There was a sense of camaraderie. There was a shared sense of having achieved something special and new, and pride in what we'd done and all of that, you know, right across the board. And of course, I didn't last so long. I mean, I basically never saw Nick again. And, you know, the next film I shot with Declan was on 35 millimeter with the same crew. And the atmosphere was quite toxic, in fact, I have to be honest, One Night Stand. So that was unique in that respect. But then a film like, let's say, Time Code.
I love Time Code.
Because they're bonkers, you know, because you're really trying something bonkers now. And so the sense of joy at, you know, the experimentation, at the idea that you're covering new ground, that, you know, the sort of energy that comes with the freshness of discovery, again, is like the end result of the film, you know, is much more to do with cinema development and the way we've gone. And it's, you know, in that respect, it's a super important film. But Leaving Las Vegas has definitely got all the emotional kind of like things around it, which you know, we're talking now because the film is coming out again, so you know, it also has this longevity.
Mike Figgis, this has been an absolute joy, and Leaving Las Vegas remains an extraordinary film. I'm sending you a very appreciative cappuccino as soon as this conversation is done.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Leaving Las Vegas is available in May 2026 on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. Just time for some more news from the world of Studio Canal, focusing this time on physical media releases that have gone up for pre-order. The 40th birthday of the 80s fantasy action extravaganza Highlander will be celebrated with a new collector's edition 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray set. It's going on sale the 29th of June, and I'm delighted to say that its director, Russell Mulcahy, will be joining me in a future episode of Studio Canal Presents to talk about the film and its special birthday. On the Vintage Classics label, Charles Crichton's 1953 comedy The Titfield Thunderbolt is making its 4K disc debut. The 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray arrives in June with an extensive collection of extra features, including a 32-page booklet as well, a poster, and brand new artwork. And one a bit further ahead, the 50th anniversary of Nicholas Roeg's iconic The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring, of course, David Bowie, is being marked with a new collector's edition 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray set. It's up for pre-order now with a release date in October 2026. I'm sure we'll have a bit more on that in future episode. And that brings us to the end of this special instalment. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram, and TikTok. Till the next time, ta-ta for now.